Today, the Omnichannels incoming. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, world notice post covering finance and property news. Friday evening, Tarek's back. Hi Tarek, nice to see you again.
Nice to see you too, mate. There's certainly plenty to talk about.
Well, we have an omni-shambles, you know, I think that's a good way to describe it. And I was thinking about the title of this show. It was a bit long, but it should be Omni-shambles incoming, cometh the hour, cometh the man, based on what we saw from Albo this week.
Well, you just don't really know where to look, do you? You've got Albo doing his address, which was underwhelming, you know, widely seen as underwhelming, even from elements of the Australian left. And speaking of the shambles, you've got everything that's going on with President Trump and the war with Iran and, you know, the brewing crisis that could be, you know, sort of the end of the economic cycle as we know it for a while here. It could be something that we haven't seen in a very long time, a supply chain induced recession rather than something, you know, a little bit more complex, perhaps, as we saw during the pandemic.
Well, a point I think I want to make is that it's a bit like the pandemic in the foothills before the pandemic. But the big difference this time is this is not a turn it off and turn it back on again, right? Everyone was surprised by how quickly, post the pandemic, when the lockdowns were unwound, how things bounced back. The point to understand is that we are not going to see a bounce back this time. Even if everything settled down in the Middle East today, it would take months and months and months for things to actually begin to modulate back down to something towards normal, if it ever does. And of course, those on the ends of the very long supply chains, like Australia, for example, is going to find it's going to take a long, long time. So that's the first point. The second point is, it's very interesting listening to different world leaders and how they're tackling. Starmer, actually, in the UK, made an address when he said it's going to get difficult ahead, et cetera, et cetera. But I thought the Korean story, the Korean prime minister, actually really made a very significant point.
No, absolutely. And it's funny that you should say that, because I was actually going to raise this point to discuss this in detail. This is, I got a few little bit of an excerpts of the transcript of what the South Korean Lee Jae-myung said. And I do apologize if I mispronounced his name there at all. I earnestly appeal to all citizens to actively participate in energy-saving movements in their daily lives, such as taking public transport and conserving electricity. The current crisis is not a passing shower that quickly subsides, but rather a massive storm whose duration is uncertain, making it all the more severe. The government recognizes this crisis as an economic warlike situation and is mobilizing all available resources to overcome the challenges at hand. If we save every drop of fuel, avoid wasting even a single plastic bag, and add a spirit of mutual consideration and collective resolve, we can emerge from the tunnel of crisis safely and swiftly. And I think it's worth noting that that comes from the leader of a nation that is two important things, that has two important things. One, it has one of the largest reserves of fuel and oil on the face of the earth. South Korea could see their oil imports stop tomorrow, and they would, on paper, have enough reserves to be able to supply themselves for at least 6 months. And that's without rationing, without any form of conservation, just normal levels of consumption. And the very important point, the second point here for Australia, is that that is the leader of the single largest provider of Australian fuel imports talking to his own people. How they need to save every drop of fuel, how they need to ensure that their country doesn't go without. Now, I'm just going to look at this like a human being and think, if they're confronted with a situation where they've got a choice between conserving fuel and hitting their own economy, or letting their existing supply, let their existing export contracts go without, I think we know which one they're going to choose, purely based on that, you know, very, very cold calculating math that defines human life, especially in crisis.
absolutely. And it's very interesting to note the differential now between the cost of diesel in the European sphere versus the Asian sphere. In fact, now diesel shipments are being redirected from Europe down to Asia, and they're nearly doubling the price of the diesel. In other words, if you've actually got a ship somewhere in the world and you want to make more money, you're going to send it down to Asia, because that, of course, is going to increase your returns. But that means that this is not something that's just going to be out there in Asia or somewhere. It's going to hit everybody. And I think that some of the European countries have yet to really understand the consequences of all of this, the battle for the meager resources. And as we'll see later when we go through your slides, you know, this isn't just about oil. It's about fertilizer. It's about pharmaceuticals. It's about helium. It's, oh, the list goes on and on. Plastics. You know, this is now looking like a significant long-term shock. And it's the sort of shock that can shake markets, it can shake countries, it can shake lives, and it can shake political parties. And I don't think that we should be assuming this time around that central banks are suddenly going to be cutting rates to zero, and suddenly all the governments around the world are going to be able to hand out lots and lots of money to people to get by. Because actually, even if you handed out money, there are no things to buy, because this is a supply shock.
Exactly. I think that that is an absolutely key point in all of this, is that we have got accustomed to a crisis of prices, of things getting a lot more expensive, but of them still being available. Whereas in this instance, you're talking about a crisis of availability, of about people not being able to sell you something because they physically do not have it. And I think, to be honest, that some of the commentary that looks at how this is going to play out, the psychology, the balance of supply versus demand in different places, is that I don't think it adequately factors in how that supply is distributed. And what I mean by that is that, you know, they say, oh, well, it's 11% of the world's oil that's gone missing. Yes. Okay. That is correct. 11% of the world's oil production and fuel production has gone missing. Yes. But do we honestly think that fuel and oil producers are not going to take care of their own needs first? That the US is going to turn around and be like, here, Australia, have all of this? Or that any number of other oil producing nations is going to turn around and they're going to say, yes, here, we're going to give all this to you and not look after ourselves first? So it needs to be looked at in the context of how much actual exportable supply is there. So an interesting example of this is Russia. Russia is one of the largest oil producers on the face of the planet. It's now, you know, outside of the Middle East closed down, it has become even more vital than it was previously. Russia has turned around and it's banned gasoline exports. It's banned sizable elements of its fertilizer export as it seeks to look after itself. And part of that is the Ukrainian attacks on its refinery infrastructure, its oil infrastructure. But it just goes to show how much that can change. And the problem is that how do you then distribute the remaining oil that is exportable and marketable across the world with all of that flow from the Strait of Hormuz taken out of the equation? Obviously not all of it, but the vast majority of it. And we'll get into the minutiae of exactly how much it's been impacted later with a nice chart. But I did an analysis purely based on three factors for countries: oil consumption, oil production, and GDP per capita in nominal US dollars, right? To figure out who exactly is the least able to pay in the event of a major crisis like this. And then compare that to the relative shortfall of about 11 million barrels per day. Now, what I came up with is basically, if you just decide that the world's 3 billion poorest people don't get their oil, don't get their gas, then that will solve the shortfall. But that means that 3 billion people don't get their oil and don't get their gas, and it would be one of the greatest humanitarian disasters in the history of the world. And that is what we need to confront going forward, because we're in the stage now where we're worrying about ourselves, which is absolutely the right thing to do, because we need to stop from our economy going into a recession or if you look at a more severe fuel rationing scenario, a technical depression. But when you look at things on a more longer term basis, and you look at the fact that demand destruction simply isn't going to be there to that degree without just prices on the absolute moon, who misses out? How do you decide who misses out? How do you distribute the absolutely catastrophic levels of human suffering that comes along with that? Now, I know this may sound like hyperbole and exaggeration, but unfortunately it isn't. And I truly hope that this situation somehow does not come to pass.
Well, you can see how it could play out, especially at a time when international cooperation and international trust is, well, frankly, in the toilet, right? So whereas perhaps 20, 30 years ago, there would have been the United Nations, you know, being able to do some stuff and perhaps some, you know, begin to actually negotiate. Well, it's very much Trump's view of the world is the US first, hang everybody else. Other people are sort of trying to react and sort of react differently. The Eurozone, I think, will be quite interesting to see how that goes. But you're right, it is actually some of those countries who really are closer to the poverty line, and a lot of people in those countries close to the poverty line now, who potentially will be firstly impacted. But I think it's very important to understand this is not going to be something which is just going to be out there, you know, down in Africa or, you know, up in the Philippines or something. This is going to actually hit every household, every doorstep, every corner, because the fundamental structural basis on the way that the global economy was built and has been built, based on financialization, based on the global price of oil, all those things, is now in question. As you say, supply going down, but supply not equally going down to everybody. And again, the people with big armies, the people with big muscles, politically or militarily, potentially will be able to play the game differently to those without. And, you know, when you look into this horrendous pool of grief that potentially is ahead, you just say, well, I hope that sense will prevail and that cooler heads will come to understand that there has to be an alternative. But at the moment, I can't see it.
I see this all playing out a little bit like the various crises of the 14th century of basically, you know, and I mean, that was a, you know, disease and climate induced, you know, climate shift induced period of just extreme upheaval. You know, the kickoff of the Hundred Years' War, you know, major famines. But one of the defining characteristics of that era, mostly in Western Europe, you know, which is where I've sort of focused my studies on this, is how people, how kingdoms treat, and even smaller regions treated food security. They first, I mean, in parts of France, they first looked after themselves. They focused on ensuring that their region had food before they considered sending things off to a more centralized distribution system. And that's before you even consider the fact that there was things like export bans on food. Now, there were instances where there were times where some, where one nation would have a bountiful harvest. They would have technically had enough to share, but because of export bans, they didn't. And then other people starved. And then obviously, as time went on, you then saw the reverse. It was a different it was a different country with the surplus and a different country in need. And I don't think that the underlying human psychology has changed. And I think part of the problem is that you're not just talking about food, it's a very visceral, very obvious need. You're talking about energy, which is a little bit more abstract. You're talking about the fuel that powers economies. Now, while it may seem, or it may even be, the moral thing to do, to share it around, to be able to help people in need, if you're leading a major developed economy or a major developing economy, and you've got the choice between keeping your economy going at 90%, 95% of normal, or taking a hit and sharing it with somebody else, you're not going to do that. I mean, you know, maybe it's the morally right thing to do, but it's not the thing that will happen. You know, we're already seeing, you know, hoarding and stuff like that. And it's just, it's a really challenging future to really assess. And I think, you know, it's also just how is all this going to be distributed in this world? Is it just going to be prices? Because I look at, say, like countries like India. India, while it's a massive economy, it doesn't really have the purchasing power to be able to afford all of this. But India also has some major diplomatic clout and some geopolitical clout, which I imagine that the Modi government is most certainly going to use to get what it needs. I mean, and China's not the richest country in the world on a per capita basis, and obviously higher energy prices would hit them hard as well. But I don't see them going without either. So you're already entering that situation where the pool of available resources was already shrunk, but now it's being shrunk further and further and further by geopolitical factors, by other economic factors, and it's just an absolute mess.
It is, absolutely. And the trouble is, I think, that people haven't really fully understood the profound long-term consequences of this. I find it quite interesting that Albo, of course, in his speech at the press club, was actually committing to changing the tax breaks for investment property. And I'm thinking, you what? I mean, that's an important little sideshow. But in the current context, you know, is that really where the focus needs to be? Property prices are going to fall. If this plays out as I think it will, property prices are going to fall. And it may well be appropriate to reduce the tax breaks for property investors in some way. But it's like, you know, I don't know whether you feel the same way, but I feel as though I'm on one planet, he's on another planet.
I felt that I'm on a different planet to Albo for quite some time, unfortunately. I think a lot of people feel relatively similarly, that we live in two very different versions of Australia. But I don't know, I sort of get the feeling that that's almost just a little bit of just theatre, shall we say. Because Albo knows that if we're sitting here come budget night, and the Strait of Hormuz is still as it is, everything remains status quo, you know, fuel stocks are starting to get impacted potentially, things are getting worse, things are getting very clearly worse in other parts of the world. I don't think too many people are going to hold him to account on the tax reform for property investors element of the press club speech, because I don't think people are really going to care. But in the short term, I think it does focus attention on those things, because instead of people saying, where's the fuel, Albo? Where's the fuel? And, you know, that's something that he has, you know, that the government has avoided talking about in detail on a few occasions now. I think that, you know, it serves a purpose in the sense that it keeps the public focused and even parts of the media, keeps them focused on something else rather than the smack to the back of the head that's collectively coming for Australia if this continues. And that's not even getting into the issues of things like, you know, fuel supply issues hitting us personally. You know, that's a whole other story, which we'll get into the weeds a little bit later in the show.
Absolutely. Well, I have to say that there's a bit of a parallel to my mind. You know, we had the Epstein files in the US and Trump was trying to sort of weave and dive around them. Well, of course, no one's talking about the Epstein files now because everyone's talking about the war. And I'm thinking, well, that's a very convenient outcome, isn't it? You know, everyone's now worrying about the Straits of Hormuz and oil, et cetera, et cetera. And no one much is talking about Epstein anymore. So the plan worked.
Somehow, if that was the intention, I don't think it's quite worked out the way that he planned. I think it was more of a little thought of a weekend jaunt, maybe 3 or 4 days tops of come in, decapitate the leadership, then, you know, move on. You know, another win for America, add it to the trophy case alongside Venezuela. And it certainly hasn't worked out that way. And I think that part of the problem at this stage is that, you know, to paraphrase you know, Matthew Ridgway, one of the US generals during the World War II Korea Vietnam era, you know, one of the only worst things about getting into a bad war is getting out of it.
It's much easier to start than stop, isn't it? Well, let's move on to your slides. And we should just explain to our viewers that Zoom has been playing around with its app, and it's made it rather more difficult to do what we normally do. But what we're going to do is we're going to switch over to the slide view, and we will basically be talking against those slides, and there will be less cutting back between that and the and us. But never mind, the slides are the thing.
All right, brilliant. Normally, the charts will be available at burnetteconomics.com, but from now on, they will be available at Twitter, and I will get Martin to include a link in the description, and we'll get straight into the slides. Now, I've made the comment in the past that part of the problem, if Australia faced a crisis, was that we've spent much of the scope that we could have had for stimulus on just keeping the plate spinning, just as if everything were a normal day. And I actually went through and I did the math on this based on various different recessions and crises since the 1980s. And what I found was that the expansion of the size of government on a day-to-day basis under the Albanese government has been larger than the expansion during almost any recession. So, and naturally that includes, you know, all manners of support mechanisms and stimulus, etc. So the problem is that unless we want to take government as a proportion of the economy to its highest level since the current record set began, the scope for stimulus to support the economy is very, very limited. But somehow I don't suspect that that is going to be too much of an issue. I kind of get the feeling that we're just going to set off for brave new heights and to hell with it. And we'll just have a bigger and bigger and bigger government, because that at the end of the day is what powers economic growth in Australia for much of the time in the past decade, but particularly since the pandemic.
Yeah, and it's just worth highlighting two things. One is the cost of debt is a lot higher because interest rates are a lot higher at the moment. And secondly, we've already seen the first outings from the point of view of the government with regard to support already costing a bit, you know. Having said that, the higher GST take on the higher oil prices will actually give them some fiscal space for doing some of this.
That is indeed an important point in all of this, and I think that that's what we're going to see quite a bit going forward, is that this crisis is going to boost the price of LNG. It's going to boost the price of thermal coal, of coking coal, because a lot of these countries that were reliant on, say, Qatari LNG to power their electricity sector are now switching their old coal-fired power plants back on to keep the lights on. And obviously, you're going to see a surge in demand for coal in that regard. So, you know, bully for Australia. So, there is that second order effect coming for Australia, that boost to the budget bottom line. So there will be fiscal scope for them to throw money at the economy, but it will mean that the government has to get larger again, and I don't think that that's an especially welcome thing in the grand scheme of things. I think that if we were talking about government getting larger because we were providing a much greater quality of services to the Australian people than we once did, you know, say for example, that we really upped our game with education, we really upped our game with healthcare, and everything was absolutely world beating and fantastic, then I think it could be justified, but it can't be. It's just been this huge expansion in taxpayer-funded employment, in this huge expansion in government, and it hasn't resulted in those boosts to the outcomes at the coal face that you would associate with just this absolutely huge expansion in the size of the role of government on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, my final point on this one, Tarek, is that, of course, the point about government handouts and those sorts of things. Well, it may keep the economy ticking over at one level, and there's an expectation amongst households that the government will save them as they did in COVID. But if there's nothing to buy because the supply chains are broken, and if you can't get the oil in the first place, actually, maybe it's not going to help much, which is the other point, going back to this fact that it's a supply side shock this time.
That's definitely a factor in all of this. I think that there's definitely that element. And I think it's also just the fact that even if they just throw money at the economy, and even if we are one of the lucky countries that we don't have the direct supply issues, everything's just more expensive on a longer run basis, it's just highly inflationary. It's inflationary to begin with, because you're competing with the rest of the world for goods that have been impacted by, you know, this issue feeding through global supply chains. But then you're just going to have the fact that you've got even greater demand from the fact that government's juicing it using the fiscal levers. So it's just really quite a mess in that regard. It's just, there are no real easy good options here. Not that we've had really easy good options for a while now, but I mean, there's a reason why we still have a rental crisis years and years after the pandemic's over.
Absolutely. And point, of course, all of this, I made a show the other day talking about stagflation, when you've got, on one hand, the inflation rate very high, on the other, growth rates very low. And the 70s was an example. The 1970s was an example of stagflationary impacts because of high oil prices. And some people are saying, oh, it's not as bad this time, to which I reply, well, maybe there's a little less dependency on oil, but there's a hell of a greater dependency on LNG, plus a whole bunch of other things that we now are actually using that we used less of previously. So to my mind, the stagflation story is worth watching. Now, let's talk a little bit then, Tariq, about consumers and how they're reacting to all of this. Because one of the really interesting angles here is what's going on with regard to consumer confidence.
Indeed. This is a very interesting one here from ANZ. Now, this ANZ's confidence index has long been my preferred choice of the various ones produced here in Australia. It's long lived. It's backed up by Roy Morgan, and it has tended to be the closest to reality, I would say, in terms of actual outcomes for consumers on a per capita basis. And what we've seen in recent weeks is it's fallen to its lowest level on record since records began in 1972. And then and that was last week. And then this week it fell to another new record low. So consumers are in trouble. And I think it's just worth noting that this was already low and in a bad place before the war. And that, you know, that's, I think, a theme that's a little bit recurring in all this going forward. And the reality is that, you know, per capita consumer spending was already going backwards before the war started on a year-on-year basis, according to the CBA data. And I think people are just in a really bad spot. And I think as well that, you know, this is something that you and I go on and on about, but that masks a wealthy, generally older cohort powering ahead, you know, which is obviously not entirely defining for the age demographic, but just a subset of that cohort. And then there's a whole lot of people, and I would say this is a sizable majority, who are falling behind.
Yeah, and just on that, there was a very interesting piece of statementry in the most recent Financial Stability Review report from the RBA, who was essentially saying that things were pretty good, you know, real incomes are rising and people have actually got ahead with their mortgages. So everything is fine, and people should be able to weather any shocks from the Middle East, no problem at all. But they said on average, and I want to come back again, the point is, there is no such thing as an average household. There are households in very different dispositions from those who are actually feeling no real pain at the moment through to those who are actually up against it already. And I'm afraid that I found the RBA's stance rather disingenuous. Plus, of course, the fact that that was before the depths of the risks coming out of the oil crisis were really coming to the fore. So I think that we've got another, you know, very important read here. The Westpac Melbourne Institute data also was extremely depressed as well. So this isn't just one survey. This is actually true. I'm seeing it in my surveys too, by the way, as well. And I'm already seeing an incremental increase in those people with cash flow pressures. The point I want to make, though, Tarek, is that confidence level so low and the pressure on households from cash flows now is all before the supply disruptions are really coming through. I suspect that once those come through, we're going to see those indices going even lower. And I'm not sure that even government largesse is going to be able to solve it.
No, I know, because I think the thing is it's about the scale of the issue that we face with all of this. Now, we've seen in recent days, you know, Albo talk about trotting out lending to small businesses, which you know, is just a repeat of what we saw during the pandemic. And let's be honest, it never worked to get money to small businesses. What it did is it delivered cheaper fixed rate housing mortgages. So I wouldn't be surprised to see TFF 2.0 or any other rerun of various support mechanisms. And I think that's one of the things that's just going to be so interesting about this, because it's not something where, like you said, you can just easily just throw money at it. Okay, you can throw a bit of coin at it, but it's not going to solve the problem. And I think to be honest, that just makes the fact that this could just be a relatively, shall we say, housing focused stimulus to the forefront, because, you know, they're going to want to do whatever they can, but the options are limited. And so is the imaginations involved, I would imagine.
Oh, yes, the imagination is severely limited. And I'll make the point, of course, that going back to Albo's speech the other day, they want to turn down the investment housing part of the market. Just go back through post-COVID. There was a huge surge in the investment property story, which, of course, supported home prices. And sure, through recalling again, home prices went up dramatically directly after COVID because of all the largesse, because of the ultra low interest rates, because of the other things, people raiding superannuation, all of those things were actually part of the reason why we had one, inflation, and two, why we also had this massive house price run up. So the question for me, Tarek, is, are they going to try and do the same again? But I don't think the circumstances are the same this time around because of the supply side issues. And if people want to actually understand, this changes the economics of oil and oil exploration considerably. And a good indication of that is what's going on with the WTI price. Oh, and interesting question. Maybe we should be thinking about oil under our own feet in Australia.
I recently did an article for Yahoo Finance on the viability of Australia having a more self-sufficient oil sector. So basically, what does our oil reserves actually look like? Now, in terms of what the International Energy Agency believes to be what they call exploitable, and that's basically what can be developed at, you know, profitably at today's prices, it's somewhere between about 1.8 and about 2.5 billion barrels of oil, and Australia goes through about 420 million a year. So it's doable. You could get a fair bit of oil out of that, you know, maybe 5 years, 6 years, because, you know, maybe a bit longer, but that would be about it. But in a paper by the International Energy Agency, there is also a little note that Australia actually has 400 billion, that's billion with a B, barrels of shale oil underneath our fair land, of which, excuse me, about 17 billion are considered technically viable for development. The problem with that oil, though, is that developing it would be expensive because you would need to, because it's shale, you would need to frack for it. So part of the issue with that is, unlike, say, for example, in the US, where you've got oil fields in, say, Pennsylvania, you know, in rural Pennsylvania and places like that, that aren't all that far from things like electricity or water or all this, all manner of other infrastructure. Australia's are obviously off, generally speaking, in relatively rural areas. Well, very, very rural areas. And that makes them expensive. So I did a bit of a digging, comparing various projects with similar geographies in Canada, things, you know, obviously you're talking about developing, you know, shale type technology. So you need obviously similar geology, but also a relatively similar set of circumstances with related to infrastructure as it relates to water, etc. And obviously, you know, Australia's areas in very, very distant regional areas tend to be quite dry and you need a lot of water. So there's, you know, some rather serious issues there as well. But what I found is that if you make, you know, a very, very rough estimate, you're talking about $75 a barrel to develop Australia's 17 billion barrels worth of exploitable oil. Now, how exactly you choose to prioritize that, or whether you choose to prioritize that at all, is obviously in the eye of the beholder. But obviously right now, I think we could all agree that oil from that would be pretty nice.
Yes. And let's not get too caught up on the question of green and, you know, renewables, because of course, you know, there are some renewables going on in Australia at the moment. But if you look at the nature of consumption, fuel consumption in particular, well, you know, gasoline might be coming down a little bit, but diesel, not so much. And in fact, there was a report in the AFR that showed that Australia holds the prize per capita for the amount of diesel consumed.
Indeed. I got this data here below from the IEA, and then I deflated it by the working age population, because obviously Australia's population's gotten a lot bigger since this data set started in 1986. So what this shows is diesel and automotive gasoline consumption per capita over the last 40 years. And as you can see, gasoline consumption per capita has actually fallen rather dramatically. It's fallen by almost half, which is very impressive. Whereas diesel consumption has risen by, has almost doubled. Now, I think this serves to illustrate just how challenging it is to actually, for Australia to actually kick its fossil fuel habit. Because even though we have reduced emissions, even though we have done, you know, all these various different things like just sticker levels of diesel consumption within Australia hit new highs again and again and again on a fairly consistent basis. So it's a very, very challenging thing to do, because the thing is, most diesel is not consumed by road cars or even by trucks. It's consumed off the nation's roads. So, you know, it's consumed in our shipping. It's consumed by our agriculture industry, by our construction sector, by our mining sector. So it's a very, very challenging thing to confront on those particular terms.
Absolutely. And it's not going to get any better, I think, because so much of Australia is powered by diesel, whether you're looking at road transport or getting goods from farms into the shops, or whether you're thinking of, you know, farming or even the mining sector. Of course, it's interesting to just reflect on the fact that a lot of the mining sector is driven by diesel, those massive trucks that actually go around the mines. And of course, that's one of main exports from Australia as well. So in a way, Australia is so wedded. Now, in the context of that, it's just worth reflecting on the decisions that have been taken over the last 30 years as to the amount of fuel held onshore in Australia. relative to other countries. And despite the fact that we are one of the biggest users per capita of diesel, we are also one of the lowest protected in terms of onshore storage.
You're absolutely right, Martin. It's a rather ridiculous situation for us to find ourselves in. I mean, that AFR chart the other day, if you've got it, definitely chuck it up on the screen, that we are the largest per capita user of diesel, as part of the assessed data set, is nuts. And I think the thing is that the diesel economy, shall we call it, it underpins the broader Australian economy. It underpins the living standards we have. It underpins our currency. You know, people say, oh, well, you know, Australia needs to shut down mining. It needs to stop using fossil fuels. It needs to X, Y, Z. And it's like, if you take that out of the equation, Australia gets pushed towards basically being a third world country, because you've got all these Australian dollars trying to go out to buy things, but nothing coming in to actually buy anything from us. Now, you could say that, well, what about the education sector? Well, the less said about that, the better, in terms of the actual balance of how the reality of the balance of payments works once you factor in things like remittances, etc. But the reality is that is what just underpins the relative strength of our economy. And I think, in a way, it's a little, I feel like the conversation around it is actually a little bit disingenuous. And I feel like that comes from both sides of Australian politics. I feel like you get Labor just tends to avoid it. But then even from the coalition, when they say, oh, well, you know, with mining, it's about the jobs. It's like, well, not really. I don't think it is it? You know, more people work at KFC nationally than are employed in say, for example, coal mining. Yet the focus is on jobs, when in actual fact, it should be the focus on the economics of it all, on what it grants to our economy, on what it grants to the federal budget, for that matter. You know, I mean, you know, everyone talks, oh, the NDIS is expensive, yet the resources sector injects more cash into the coffers of the federal government than they spend on the NDIS. So it's just a really, really disjointed economy, in the sense of, like, we've got these ideas of, oh, Australia is this vibrant, sophisticated, technologically advanced economy that really is still very much riding on the back of a diesel powered mega mining truck in Western Australia for the most part.
Absolutely. And the other interesting thing on the next chart is you've got some distribution across the year data here, which is actually quite fascinating.
It is indeed. Now, we've all heard in recent days about the possibility of fuel rationing here in Australia, of how the government can mandate various conditions to reduce levels of fuel consumption and, you know, basically just ensure that all the various vital services get what they need. So I got to thinking, we actually have an example of that from the pandemic, most notably during the 2021 lockdowns, as to what the level of consumption, the drop-off in consumption, I should say, actually looks like in a real-world hard data example. So for once, the pandemic is actually good for something. And what this shows is that the peak drop compared with the same time of the same month of the year in 2019 for petrol and diesel combined is less than 10%. Now, I just think it needs to be just emphasized here just what that took. And also just the fact that of just what a relatively small amount of fuel that is in the grand scheme of things. Now, the question then becomes, okay, well, what if we need to, what, you know, let's, I'll give a little bit of context here. 55% of Australia's fuel that comes into Australia or thereabouts is refined from oil from the Strait of Hormuz, right? So the question then becomes, okay, let's say we missed out on a fraction of that. Let's say that our total fuel, incoming fuel supply is down by about 20%. That would be double the hit of the 2021 lockdowns, more than double. Now, I just ran that through a very, very basic, you know, sort of thing through a couple of different AIs under those conditions. And it was talking about an economic contraction of, depending on the estimate, depending on the AI, of somewhere between 3 and 8%. for larger drops, you know, say 25, 30%, then you're moving more towards the area of a technical depression. Now, I have no idea how accurate that data is, but the simple reality is it's not really something that anyone has really ever bothered to model that closely, because no one's really looked into this sort of thing all that closely before, because I don't think it's ever really been considered. I've done quite a bit of digging into finding data on oil and fuel demand destruction driven by prices and solely by prices. But yeah, it's kind of non-existent from what I can see, because it's very difficult to separate the supply issue from the inevitable impact it has on terms of causing recessions. And at that point, it becomes about the recession hitting supply, not solely about the shortage of supply.
Absolutely. And if you go on and take that argument a bit further, it's also worth asking the question about, well, what is the sales of petroleum products, and how does it flow, and how does renewables versus gas and coal and oil actually shape up? Because, again, this is a very important chart, isn't it?
Indeed. Now, this one is from the Department of Energy and Climate Change, and it's a very, very long name, but I'm not going to go through all of it. But basically, this shows the total energy consumption of Australia per year over time based on the type of energy being consumed. So we've got renewables, gas, coal, and oil. Now, oil is obviously all various oil byproducts, gasoline, jet fuel, etc. But as you can see, the share held by renewables, growing that is actually a lot more challenging than the traditional narratives and some of the commonly held narratives would suggest. Total renewables consumption is actually under 10% of the total. And I think it's just a relatively interesting little fact that the share of energy consumption in Australia held by renewables today is lower than it was 60 years ago. Because back then, hydroelectric dams made up a much greater proportion of overall energy consumption than they do today. So the pathway towards being majority reliant on renewables is a very, very long one. And I think a lot longer than some people appreciate.
And I'll tell you that a lot of people would not actually realize just how little inroad has been made through the renewables. All of the discussion about renewables, all of the subsidies and everything else that are there. When you actually look at it, Australia is being built on the back of oil and gas, et cetera, et cetera. And that's why the exposure is so severe potentially for Australia, and why at the end of very long supply chains, I come back to my earlier point, why on earth didn't we hold some more supplies locally? But it's not just oil, is it, Tarek? I think we should just spend a bit of time thinking about the fertilizer story, because the fertilizer story, well, it's shocking for Australia, but it's probably more shocking for other countries too.
It is indeed. Now, this is an interesting chart from the World Trade Organization on which nations are the most reliant on fertilizer coming through the Strait of Hormuz. And there's only one developed nation at the top of the chart, and that is Australia, with 32% of our fertilizer coming through the Strait. Now, I think it's worth having a little bit of perspective on top of this. Now, we're talking about finished fertilizer. If you want to get into things like, say, for example, ammonia, you're talking about things like sulfur, all these other vital inputs into fertilizer, many of them come from within the Persian Gulf. This is not like the 1973 oil crisis. It's not like the 1979 oil crisis, because inside the Persian Gulf, there is now all manner of industrial production that the world now relies on, whether it's aluminium, whether it's urea, whether it's ammonium, whether it's sulfur, whether it's all manner of these different things that feed into absolutely everything in our daily lives, it comes from the Middle East. So, I mean, I'll give you an example of this. Because of the impact through both LNG and the impact of sulfur and other chemicals being taken out of the equation, 4 out of 5 major fertilizer plants in Bangladesh are closed. Most of the various Indian fertilizer plants are either closed or they're currently running or doing reduced production runs because of a lack of materials. So this isn't just about the direct impact of 32% of our fertilizer is gone. That part is challenging enough as it is, but it's now also the fact that the other countries who make fertilizer are now also being impacted by the broader effects, which is going to further lower the global supply of fertilizer from an already depressed level. And to boot, an Australian ammonia factory recently had an industrial accident, which is, I believe, the largest producer of ammonia in Australia, which produces ammonium nitrate, which is used for both mining explosives and as a fertilizer. And that's going to be out of action for a while as well, which is also going to impact where we stand as a nation in terms of our fertilizer. So it's just yet another mess in a sea of messes.
Well, I use the term omni-shambles earlier on, and I do think it is an omni-shambles. You know, wherever you look, you can turn over a stone and see more issues. But it is worth, I think, just sort of bringing the conversation back to what is the deficit of oil that actually the world is facing? Because, of course, there have been some offsets. There have been pipelines that are being used that weren't being used fully before. But this Bloomberg chart really just bring it home, doesn't it?
It does. I'm really quite fond of this one. So basically, Bloomberg has done the analysis on exactly how much short there is a supply shortfall. Now, they estimate that it comes to, in net terms, about 11.1 million barrels per day, which is over 10% of global oil consumption. So of that, of the offsets that we have adding positively, there is the east-west pipeline across Saudi Arabia, which comes out in the Red Sea port of Yanbu, which is adding 3.6 million barrels per day. Now, I think this needs a little bit of context, because people are saying, well, doesn't the pipeline say it could do 5 million barrels of oil per day? And that is absolutely correct. But the thing is, it was already running at 1.4 million barrels per day prior to the conflict beginning. So that oil was already being exported around the Strait of Hormuz to begin with. Now, I just think it's also just very interesting little side note about this for our European viewers. Generally speaking, Europe still does, while Europe is not the largest consumer of oil that comes through the Strait of Hormuz and from the Middle East more broadly, it does still get a fairly sizable number in the hundreds of thousands of barrels per day. So far, of the supplies that have been coming out at Yanbu, none are going to Europe. Mm. They're all going to Asia. They're very, very aware. Asia is very, very aware of that, of the fact that they've got a problem, and they're buying up cargoes accordingly. Now, in terms of the other positive aspects, you've got the IEA releases of reserves, which is the US, Japan, and others releasing from their reserves, which adds about 2 million barrels per day. There's the sanctioned oil coming in from storage, about another million, and then the increase on the pipeline to Fujairah in the UAE, which the UAE is using to pipe oil around the Strait of Hormuz. Now, that's another one that was also already in use, but not at its full capacity. So basically, this still shows that it is effectively, even with all these boosts, the largest shock to global oil consumption, so to global oil supply ever. Now, people say, well, what about as a percentage? Well, if you take all the mitigation factors out of the equation, the, shall we say, the temporary mitigation factors, So we're talking about taking out the IEA releases and the sanctioned oil. This is still proportionally the largest oil shock in the history of man. So it is a very, very challenging set of circumstances.
Yeah, and we've just touched on oil, but of course I've mentioned helium, I've mentioned pharmaceuticals, and that means that plastics and the ability to be able to reproduce plastics is a problem too. So wherever you look, this omni-shambles becomes more and more of a question. So that was a very, very important set of slides, Tarek, and thank you very much for sharing them with us. It's really, really appreciated. But when I stand back and think about it, I got to ask the question, in the light of what we've seen with that data, how does that stack up with what we heard from Albo, that, you know, the sub 5 minute speech pre-recorded? You wrote a speech a couple of weeks ago, which I thought you shared on Twitter, which I think was probably more appropriate, really.
Oh, it was a lot more appropriate and a lot more inspiring. And I came up with that in about 10 minutes making dinner for my son. So it's a bit disappointing because it wasn't even any good. You know, it wasn't inspiring. It wasn't really much of anything. And I just think it really contrasts very poorly. Oh, I'm saying Albo's speech contrasts very poorly with the commentary from the South Korean president.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, they are in a much better better position than us. And he's saying, you know, we need to come together. We need to make sure we're not wasting a single drop of fuel. And Albo's like, Happy Easter, everyone. You know, enjoy your road trip. Even, you know, and I just think that there's just been a lack of transparency on all of this. Now, if it is true that Albo has used, you know, the power of the Australian economy to get to ensure fuel supplies to Australia or to buy additional supplies from overseas, that's fantastic. That's great. Can he share the details of that with us so we can all feel reassured as he is? But if it is the case that we haven't been able to achieve that, that we haven't been able to get the supplies that we need, and that we are heading for something of a wall in terms of supply, then can we also be told that so we can prepare for it and we can start acting accordingly? Either way, transparency should be the order of the day.
Absolutely. And it's interesting on social media, of course, there are various people trying to track the incoming movements of tankers. And it's actually quite complicated to try and do, right? Because the information is not great, really.
No, it's not. It's not. I think the problem is that a lot of it is behind paywalls, behind, you know, various different commercial sources, etc., which does certainly complicate things fairly significantly. But I mean, I think people do need to approach those websites with some caution, that the data sets are generally incomplete for that reason. Now, I'm not saying that these people aren't doing a great job and are doing a great service for Australia by putting that data out there. It is brilliant that they're doing it. I wish it was the government doing it, and that, or even that the government was just sharing their data back end with these guys, and that we could just get the data from a bunch of different websites. It doesn't really matter to me. I mean, what concerns me is just the transparency of it all, of knowing where we stand. Because where we currently sit, it just seems to me like we're just looking at a scenario where Albo just wants to avoid the obvious downside that we are unfortunately heading for.
And I just want to draw a bit of compare and contrast with the property sector, right, before we close out. Because, of course, you know, here we have a supply shock, right? and the first reaction of the government was, it's a demand problem. on the housing sector. It's a supply shock. It's not, and I'm thinking, hang on a moment, there's an important parable here somewhere.
Absolutely. It is bewildering, I would say, that the government hasn't applied the same logic to housing. And I wrote an article for Macro Business. I was on them last week or the week before. I forget exactly when, but basically it was man with economics degree discovers economics on this very topic. And the man with the economics degree is none other than Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. He has an economics degree, so he should understand supply and demand a whole lot better than the average person, but somehow doesn't when it comes to housing.
Funny that. Yes. And in the current context, I think we may well be a little confused by these two different economic theories, one being applied to housing, one being applied to oil shortages. And there's a big question mark there, isn't there, about reality versus, well, whatever you want to call the other stuff.
No, definitely. I think that there's just, well, let's be honest. Let's just look at things more broadly at the moment. Even from, you know, the perspective of the war with Iran, there's a lot of alternative reality going around at the moment, and then a lot of willfully missing the point. And I just think that we have a situation here in Australia whereby I think that the Albanese government has gotten away with murder in terms of the way that they've approached their housing policy, the way that they've approached their migration policy. And I mean, to be completely fair, it's not like that this particular flavor of failing is new. You know, this has been going on for over 20 years now, but it is arguably, and I'm sure people will argue this infinitum, that it is arguably the most acute that it has been in that 20 odd years.
Yeah, and I'll just leave everyone with this thought. Of course, jet fuel is another thing that's going to be in short supply, and maybe flights will actually have to be dialed back. Well, I suppose one advantage of that is we suddenly might find that migration eases down. On the other hand, of course, if Australia actually manages to scrape oil together and keep its own economy ticking over, well, then suddenly Australia looks even more attractive. So it's another reason why we need a proper migration policy as well.
I think that if we are heading for a continued war and a period of major global upheaval, we are going to need to take a lot of the current immigration policy, the current policy approach to asylum and all these sorts of things, and chuck it all in the bin. Because it is not, because even if you look at something, say, for example, like the Syrian and Iraqi refugee crisis and what that did to Europe, that still echoes through the annals of European social issues and European politics to this day, and through their economies and their budgets, I might add. But if you're talking about something on a scale that is over 100 times larger, potentially, you know, in terms of the level of people being impacted, what is that going to do? And not only that, but there's little old Australia with just, what is it, 27 million of us. How long would it take of people just rocking up here, you know, turning up, you know, maybe their family members, maybe their friends of people who are already here, maybe they're just, you know, particularly ambitious opportunists who just say, well, have you seen what's going on in my country? You know, have you seen what it's like there? And under the current system, you know, it's like, hey, here you have a temporary protection visa. We'll put you on the merry-go-round, see you in 8, 12 or 18 months when you can finally get a court date. What's it going to be like if a couple hundred thousand people rock up and do that? And to be completely honest with you, just purely from a, you know, go out for oneself, if I was in one of those countries and I had the choice of coming here and, you know, playing funny business, I can totally understand why you'd want to do that. And I think that we really need to start looking at the world in a less Western way, because other countries have been facing this sort of crap for decades, and they just say, no, get out or we're going to have a problem. And that's just how the rest of the world works. And I think the Western needs to catch up with the reality of things. Not that they will until it's too late, let's be honest.
No, I was thinking we should be playing The Carnival Is Over on the back of this conversation, right, as we come to the end of the show, because I actually think, you know, some of the things that people have assumed about the way that Australia is and was and what made it great is under question now. And so my question is, do we have the right leadership and political inspiration to be able to actually take us to the right place in the future? And I'll just leave that question hanging, because the carnival is over.
I was thinking more along the lines of that of the old '50s song, "It's All Over," and that's where we're at. You know, it's over. It's a new era. Things change. We adapt. We move on. And yeah, that's just the way the cookie crumbles. And I think, to be honest, that attitude is just so common outside of the West, but in the West, it's a rare one.
Absolutely. Tariq, a very, very important conversation, as always, and appreciate all the work on the slides. And I'm sure we'll be talking again, and we'll try and iron out some of the kinks with the technology updates from Zoom to make it a little bit less clunky. But anyway, very important. Thank you very much, and have a good Easter, have a good weekend, and see you soon.
Thanks, mate. Thank you for having me, and I wish all of the viewers a very happy Easter, and have a good one, folks.
Cheers.